Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone. This is stuff your doctor should know. And if your doctor doesn't know this stuff, find a new doctor. I'm coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine. And today, I have back Constantine Canardagalis. Is that how you say it? I can never say it right. It's such a cool last name. But I decided to call this hour and a half or more, actually. Every time I have Constantine on, you know, his like nickname is Dean. You know how Dean is like the head of a faculty department or head of a college or university. So this is the Dean show or the Dean hour or 2 hours. He's so good. He's so good. I can't wait to see what his future brings him because he's so darn smart. He could be the dean of a school, you know? But today we get pretty deep into some biochemistry, if you will. Like, he really knows how to go down the rabbit hole of how certain supplements work in the body. And I think that this is incredibly important for parents who have children. And not just children, but, you know, adults as well. But parents who have children in the spectrum or have children who are maybe even mildly in the spectrum where they're just exhibiting signs of tics and maybe OCD, maybe like, you know, there's different types of characteristics of, you know, being in the spectrum. And a lot of adults have them as well, you know, where... you know, we do certain things like shake our leg a lot or, you know, tap the table, tap your pen. I mean, a lot of these things can also fall under like being adrenaline dominant, but then so can these things that he's going to talk about. And I just want to say that when we talk about autism or spectrum disorder, you know, we're not talking, if you're in the spectrum or you have a child that's in the spectrum and they are thriving, we're not saying here are some things to do or give your child if they're autistic to stop them from being autistic. All I've worked with autistic children, as my husband has as well, for many years. And there are so many great characteristics that every single child that we have ever met, an adult, has that benefits them, just like everyone. Our genetic predispositions that are good, there's all kinds of things. We're not trying to say, hey, take these things so that you aren't autistic anymore. If you are thriving, don't even listen to this podcast. But if you have a child whose characteristics like these things, like tics and such, are debilitating, or they're having to suffer through them, or go to school. Tourette's is another one. These kinds of, you know, head clicking and postures and things like this that are characteristic of being in the spectrum. You know, we don't want people to suffer, and we also feel like the drugs that are used for treating these types of things can be far worse than the actual symptom itself. So Dean is going to introduce us to a bunch of awesome nutrients that play a huge role, not just in these characteristics that we're talking about, but also in hormone imbalance and hormone deficiencies like progesterone deficiency and like estrogen dominance and such. So definitely take out a piece of paper and a pen because it is very thorough and very comprehensive, as he always is. And, you're going to learn a lot. Because I really wanted to talk about the Saturae. And
I know a girl that started using a face cream recently and said anytime she saw like a pimple on her forehead within, you know, she uses it and she wakes up and there's no remnant of it, no little scarring, nothing. So it's
amazing.
I mean, and it's, you know, it has camphor, it has eugenol, it has caprylic acid, like, these things are antifungal, they're antimicrobial. They're, how many face creams have camphor and these things in it? Mm-hmm. So it's not just good for your skin or whatever. Like it's, you know, the niacinamide can prevent sun damage, and you know, the lanosterol, the lanolin can protect against the sun too, and protect against wrinkles and all these things. But it's also like good for the skin. Like it, you know, it prevents pimples or blemishes and stuff like that because it has these products. I think that's awesome. And where else are you gonna get camphor cream? Like Vicks, you know,
Right.
petroleum jelly and camphor and eucalyptus oil. It's like, well, I don't really want petroleum jelly on your body. You can just use Saturé face cream. So
Yeah, it's amazing. And do you remember if I ever told you about Dr. Marshall's oil change, where he said that when you have a lot of PUFA in the skin, he never called it PUFA though. He would always call it trans fat, or he would call it damaged fats. And he would say, you go in the sun and you cover yourself, even your hair if you want, head to toe with coconut oil, naked, lay in the sun, and then you muscle test to see if it goes off, or when it goes off, because then you take it, then you wash it all off. And he had this notion that the body would trade the good oil for the bad oil. And then, your body would uptake the coconut oil, and then it would push out whatever was in your skin. And that was just a wild concept, and I always thought it was a little bit like woo-woo. But now, I was talking to Emma in the podcast and talking about like putting like the vitamin E or the product straight into melasma or straight into lipofuscin, and that concept of osmosis, where your body will uptake the good stuff. And who knows, like maybe it does push it out, maybe it does offset it, or maybe it sends it into circulation so that you can get rid of it. I don't know. Does that make
that
sense?
reminds me of a cool product Georgie has and his boutique supplement company, Ideal Labs, DC.com. It's called Mitolipin. And the goal is to, he says, we have different phospholipids, and this will be relevant when we talk about asthma in a little bit. But you have these phospholipids, and when you're young, they're saturated. And when you, the older you get, they start getting unsaturated. And this can be really harmful. One of the reasons it's harmful is because when the phospholipids break open, when they hydrolyze through different enzymes, if they're unsaturated, they have more arachidonic acid, which can become eicosanoids. So these are like prostaglandins, leukotrienes. They're basically in inflammation, inflammatory markers. So the more saturated your phospholipids are, your cardiolipin is one of them. That's an important one. The better it is, right? And that's kind of what you're talking about, trying to replace the unsaturatedness with the saturatedness using coconut oil. But Georgie has a so phosphatidylcholine is a phospholipid, and he sells a saturated version. So the idea is you'd use it topically or orally, and the saturated phosphatidylcholine should get into your phospholipids, saturating them over time. So that's kind of Georgie's way of unsaturating, sorry, saturating, so getting rid of the unsaturated fats that make up your phospholipids, so your lipid bilayers and all that stuff, cardiolipin again, like I said. And that's really cool because other than that, I think if you want to take, you know, a phospholipid, usually it's in the form of lecithin, like from soy or sunflower. This is going to be an unsaturated phosphatidyl choline, unsaturated phospholipids. So Georgie, as far as I know, is the only one selling a saturated version. But the whole point, if you type in, listener, if you just type in mitolipin, Heydute, Haidut, you should see a Repeat Forum thing where he talks about why he made mitolipin. And it's really cool. So yeah, maybe we should talk to Georgie about mitolipin next time he's on.
Yeah,
But it's
definitely.
the same idea of what you just said with the coke. It's the same idea. It's saturating, it's replacing the fats, which is protective.
Yeah, because Dr. Marshall would say the body is always going to choose, if it has the choice, it's going to choose to use the usable product, the usable fat, right? Like
There's more
it's like,
stable fat. It'll choose
yeah.
the more stable one. Yeah.
Georgie talked about a little bit about this with Emma and Kitty once, about, I think it was with Emma and Kitty, about like, the body will do anything it needs to do just to survive, not necessarily thrive. Like if it gets used to doing a certain thing, like if all you're giving it, the majority of what you're giving it is, let's say, bad fats, your body's going to use the bad fats and do the best it can with that. But if you give the body the opportunity to use something better, it's going to upgrade and use that better thing. He said it differently, but and so it's like, yeah, so that's really cool. And so I guess Dr. Marshall was right. He said it in his own way, but what about, like, can you explain just quickly? I know we weren't going to talk about this, but the vitamin D, and sunlight and the oils in the skin and that process. Do you know very well how that process works? Like, if you're in the sun and you've got PUFA in your, like, you know, your body will push up the fats in this to the surface of the skin. Like, you'll sweat a little bit and there'll be some oils in there. And that's naturally what's supposed to protect us from sunburn and UV rays and all. And so, but if you've got these PUFA fats that come up to the surface of the skin, it's like putting baby oil on your skin and going outside. And so, the more PUFA you have in your body, the worse your liver is dealing with, you know, it's stagnation and whatever. And you go out and you push up this, like, almost like baby oil to the surface of your skin. And so you're sunburned. You're like, why do I sunburn so much compared to when I was a kid? Right. And so that happens. How does that PUFA, let's say, that's on your skin in the sunlight, how does it interfere with vitamin D production? Do you know?
So I'm not sure how much those two things are related, but the more unsaturated the fats are on your skin, the more likely that sun will damage your skin, because if the fats on your skin are unstable, then things like light and heat can, lead to lipid peroxidation and other issues quicker than something like a really good saturated fat levels in your skin. And when it comes from vitamin D, the sun hits our skin and reacts with the cholesterol in our skin, and different enzymes happen, and then you get vitamin D. So, for in your last episode with Emma Skourakis, with her saturated product, she talked about how they have lanolin in it, and they make vitamin D out of lanolin. I think they irradiate lanolin, and that's how we have supplemental vitamin D. But we make something similar, right? It's cholesterol, and when the sun hits the cholesterol, it becomes vitamin D, through various enzymatic processes. But even putting on lanolin as like a skin cream, that actually, I think, might help your body actually make more vitamin D itself. Because if you're putting the very thing that we get supplemental vitamin D from on your skin and you let sun hit it, that might help you make vitamin D. So, make more, if you're eating more saturated fat and your skin is more saturated, it's more stable, you'll probably make vitamin D better, probably. Your skin will definitely be more protected from the sun. And a lot of people will say stuff like, oh, if you take vitamin E orally, that can be like sun protection. Well, I think if there's any truth to that, it's because the vitamin E is protecting the polyunsaturated fat that you do have maybe in your skin from reacting poorly to the sun and, peroxide and stuff. So vitamin E internally, I think in theory, can be really good for your skin, protecting it from sun damage. People say put saturated fat on your skin to protect from the sun. So lanolin in the skin cream is a saturated thing. Coconut oil saturated, shea butter, I'm pretty sure, is coconated. Sorry, saturated.
That's a great word, coconated.
Coconated. What's the other one? Cocoa butter, like chocolate. Like, that's very saturated. A lot of soaps, the good kind of soaps, are made from like tallow, right? So like beef or even sheep fat. So when you're thinking of skin, anything saturated is good. Creams, soap, or eating saturated things. Coconut oil, eggs, tallow. The more, polyunsaturated things. So if you're a pescatarian and you only eat salmon, the sun, I think, is way more dangerous for you than if you're someone that only eats lamb fat. So yeah, I think it didn't really answer your question about the vitamin
No,
D
it
part, but
did. That totally
the
did.
cholesterol is important.
Right. It has to,
And there, yeah.
Yeah, you have to have those healthy things in order for you to synthesize and make the vitamin D on the skin surface. And, that's why they say, oh, you want to get vitamin D, go out in the sun. Well, what happens when you go out in the sun? You create this little beaded sweat that comes to the surface of your skin that has oil that's there to protect you. If the oil that comes out is like baby oil, is polyunsaturated fats, PUFAs, then yeah, that's going to definitely interfere. That makes perfect sense because it does in the
Yeah, and I,
body.
and
So
quickly, I have a friend. This was years ago, but he's in medical school now. But before he went to medical school, he did a year of like, I don't know, something biology, some master's of biology or something. And he did a, they were doing little biopsies of skin of people that have bad psoriasis. And I said, well, what did you find? Like, what was the main things, in that psoriatic skin? And he said that they found a lot of basically polyunsaturated fats, lots of arachidonic acid, and other fatty acids that are omega-6, some omega-3, and omega-3s are actually, they're more unstable. So that's why I said pescatarians would be not having a good time in the sun, because they're eating a lot of unsaturated fats. Like if you're eating peanuts, it's pretty unsaturated, the fat, but salmon is way more unsaturated. But anyway, he told me there was lots of unsaturated fat found in the skin of where psoriasis was, way more so than normal skin without psoriasis. So,
Interesting. And I wonder, could you Max Casa has that amazing magnesium soak, and then there's all these different ways that you can excrete exogenously from the skin, but uptake things like magnesium, or like get in the sauna, dry brushing. I wonder how effective all that stuff is with helping to get rid of PUFA. Emma was saying you have to be very careful when you want to move PUFA out of the skin. And I'll tell you, it makes perfect sense because when people now remember when I first met you and talked to Georgie and everyone that I talked to of the guests that you recommended, I think I've asked them all, how come I get sick or how come people get so nauseous when they take vitamin E? And it makes perfect sense because now that I'm working with Ona's and Eric talks about and Dr. Pete talked about when that oil gets into it's so vitamin E is so good for the gut. It's so good for the lining of the stomach and the lining of the intestines, excuse me, and the stomach. And when that vitamin E gets in there, it's probably pushing out PUFA. And when that PUFA gets into your stomach in a like a big squirt like that, I bet it's super nauseating. Like when I used to do the liver flushes, like the ones where you drink the raw olive oil. I mean, the nausea that would ensue. And you think, oh, it's the bile, or oh, it's just drinking that much oil, but it's not. It's like it's displacing the PUFA. And I think that that PUFA is so toxic and rich and like it's like motor oil, Anyway.
yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, vitamin E is very, it is very thick though. Anything that thick will could lead to nausea, right? So that part is still a factor too.
Okay. So, what have you been up to lately? So I was wondering about all of these amazing studies you've been sending me, and now I realize that you were finding them because of your schooling and your access to all this stuff, right?
Well, I mean, I'll be in throughout the day. I'll have different thoughts and want to investigate different questions I'm thinking of. Like, recently I've been looking at a lot of different things, especially to do with glutamate, and obviously NMDA, which the NMDA, when that activates, you have glutamate that comes from that. So different things like this. And why? Because high glutamate, high NMDA activation has been shown to be part of a lot of different behavioral and mood issues, like including ADHD, OCD, even epilepsy and stuff, Tourette's, tic disorders in children. So, it has a really wide variety of conditions and disorders it affects. But anyway, so I was just telling you that, when I'm researching these things and I see a study that, is not free. Luckily, since I'm a university student, I can almost always access the full study through my university. Not always, which sucks. Sometimes you find a really good study and you go, wow, I really want to read, you know, the whole paper, but even my university access won't get it for me. But sometimes, you know, Kyle Mamoon is actually, I sent him a study once thinking he's a researcher, PhD, maybe he'll have access. And he did. And he sent me a paper one time. So thank you, Kyle Mamoon. So I find
nice.
My ways of getting these studies, basically, because a lot of people, if you just type in Google Scholar, whatever, if you type in PubMed, a lot of the papers won't be free. And you're not going to pay $34 for something that might actually not be a good study. Like, you don't know.
Yeah.
You have to read it to find out. So,
that's
yeah.
Almost all Lancet stuff is not free. And JAMA, a lot of it. Well, that's cool. So what did you find out about glutamate? And
tell us what it is. Yeah, so today I wanted to talk about asthma and then and MDA glutamate stuff. So let's start with the NMDA glutamate stuff thing. So basically... glutamate, you have glutamine, which is an amino acid, and glutamine can be good for gut health. It is an amino acid used to kind of rebuild the gut lining and stuff like that. And if people take it as a supplement, you'd want it under 5 grams, because if it's under 5 grams, it's likely that the gut will just use it for rebuilding purposes. But glutamine can become, usually not glutamine's fault, usually the body just wants more glutamate, so they turn glutamine into glutamate. And glutamate is it's a excitotoxic neurotransmitter. We do need it because it's very sympathetic driving. It's very stimulating and things like that. But a lot of mood and behavioral disorders are pretty much shown to be, or at least theorized to be, situations where glutamate is it's too high. It's not at a level where it should be. It's, you know, inappropriately high is what I should say. And the funny thing is, though, in the body we have glutamine turns to glutamate, but then glutamate becomes GABA, which is shocking to someone that didn't know this, because GABA is almost in every way the opposite of glutamate. Glutamate is excitatory, excitotoxic, makes you very anxious. And GABA is the major inhibitory neurotransmitter, which means it inhibits those nerve signalings and things like that. So GABA makes you calm. It's good for sleep. Benzodiazepines, benzos, they work on the GABA system. So they make you super calm. So GABA is anti-anxiety. Glutamate is pro, you know, ADHD, OCD, Tourette's, anxiety, depression, anything you could think of. So I was really thinking, wow, okay, I want to learn more about this glutamate GABA thing, because a lot of, like, let's pick OCD, for example, but this is relevant for any kind of, like, thing I just mentioned, even, like, epilepsy and like, convulsing. So a lot of, like, if you think about OCD, a lot of the research, they'll say it's one of three things. There's other things, but here's three examples. I say you might have too high glutamate. That's one. Two is you might have too little GABA. And three is you might have an imbalance of glutamate or GABA. Well, given glutamate turns into GABA, it's likely that if you have too much glutamate and too little GABA, you might have an issue turning the glutamate into the GABA. So I found out vitamin B6, out of all the B vitamins, it depends on who you ask. Some people say there's 8 B vitamins. Some people say there's like 10 or 11, because some people include choline and other things as a B vitamin. But, you know, there's 8. That's the consensus. Out of those 8, B6, so it's called pyridoxine, seems to be used successfully in so many of these conditions. Like, and I'm not just like ADHD and things, even it's B6 has been given to autism spectrum, you know, children and people, and they've seen some benefit in different factors, different markers. So why would B6 help? Well, B6 does a bunch of things. And I think B6 is probably the most important B vitamin as a therapy for behavioral and mood things. So B6, one of the things it does is it is the required nutrient for the enzyme that actually converts glutamate to GABA. So if you're a person that thinks, I might have high glutamate and low GABA, instead of taking GABA or taking things that increase GABA, which can be okay, I have no problem with like theanine or taurine, which can increase GABA, you might do better taking B6 because B6 will not only lower your glutamate, it will also increase your GABA, as opposed to let me try to block GABA or let me try to block glutamate. Let me try to increase GABA. Why don't you do both by taking B6, right? And I'm not saying everyone should go and take B6, but in theory, it can be very helpful. And there's many studies, like for example, with ADHD, they took little school children. So, they probably weighed like 70, 80 pounds, way less than the average adult, obviously. And they gave them 50 milligrams of active B6, which is called pyridoxal 5-phosphate. So it's called P5P. So when I'm talking about B6 throughout this episode, I'm always referring to taking P5P because this is very important because a lot of people say B6 is toxic. Well, it seems that it's likely that a lot of the toxicity B6 is from one of two things. One, you might be taking way too much B6. So toxicity can be found in B6 if you're taking really massive doses. So I'm talking about multiple hundreds of milligrams, not like 50 or 20 milligrams. That's one. Two, there's a very cheap form of B6, a B6 salt. It's called pyridoxine HCl, so pyridoxine hydrochloride. Pyridoxine hydrochloride, first of all, about 10% of it turns into the P5P, which is the type of B6 we can use. So if you're taking 100 milligrams of pyridoxine HCl, you're probably only getting 10 milligrams of P5P, but it's worse than that. Taking pyridoxine HCl has been shown at certain doses to actually lower the enzyme that turns pyridoxine to P5P. So by taking bad, or I shouldn't say bad, by taking cheap B6, you might actually be giving yourself a B6 deficiency by lowering the conversion of inactive to active B6. So I think some levels of pyridoxine HCl are fine. And people like Chris Masterjohn, PhD, has talked about how he's met some people that, because of their body makeup or wherever they are right now in their health level, they actually did better with pyridoxine than P5P. I'm not sure why someone would do better with pyridoxine as opposed to P5P, but it's possible. So I don't want to say pyridoxine HCl is always bad or you should always avoid it, but it seems to me that if you want to get the benefits of taking P5P as like a therapy, B6 as a therapy, you'd probably want to stick with P5P. You probably wouldn't want to take doses that are very high, like 100 milligrams. So this one study on ADHD, and there's multiple, they took these kids for 2 months. They gave them 50 milligrams of P5P, which is pretty large, but they're children and they had no adverse effects. So that should tell you something about its toxicity, right, or not. And magnesium. And that's another thing I noticed. They almost always give magnesium with B6 in anything they're studying. Tourette's, ADHD, autism, OCD. It's always like P5P plus MG. That's what it says in the study.
Wow.
P5P, vitamin B6 plus magnesium. And there's reasons for that, and I'll get to it soon. But basically, these ADHD kids put on 50 milligrams of P5P, I think 100 milligrams of magnesium, but you can do way more than that, I think, for 2 months. And they're, hyperactivity and all these different markers were markedly improved. They got up way less in class. They were way less disruptive. They were paying attention more. I think even marks improved, but it was only for 2 months. And these were children again, right? So, I mean, if you're an adult and you're thinking you have different behavioral issues, like, always talk to your doctor, but it seems that if little children can improve greatly by some B6 and magnesium, it's probably pretty safe for most people, but B6 isn't for everyone. So I don't think B6 and magnesium are only working because B6 helps turn glutamate to GABA, although that's huge. There's something called the kynurenine pathway. So basically, when you eat tryptophan, which is an amino acid, and people know it's in like chicken and poultry and turkey and stuff, tryptophan in an ideal state will become vitamin B3, niacin. In a bad situation, so not an optimal health situation, a lot of this tryptophan can become toxic things. Curanine and quinolinic acid is a very major one. Quinolinic acid has been shown to be very involved in a lot of mood and behavioral issues, including things like autism. Quinolinic acid is supposedly very high in the brains of these children or, adults. Same with ADHD, OCD, Tourette's, tic disorder, like you name it. Epilepsy, of course. Epilepsy, they found a lot of quinolinic acid in these people. So what's the deal here? It is a very necessary component of the pathway of tryptophan, niacin, to have B6 and magnesium. Also, to a lesser extent, B2, and I believe even iron, which is, funny, but the main ones is B6 and magnesium. So I was reading a paper on chronic tic disorders for children, and part of the reason why they were using, in this study, they used B6 and magnesium, just like the ADHD study. Part of their reason was, well, we want tryptophan to turn to niacin and not quinolinic acid down the bad curine pathway mechanism. So they said B6 and magnesium are essential for this. And another paper on Tourette's syndrome, which is Tourette's is like a more severe version of a tic disorder. A lot of young boys will get what's called the tic disorder. It's usually a motor tic, so eye blinking or something like that, and it typically goes away. But when you have Tourette's syndrome, I believe that's a motor tic and a phonic or vocal tic. So it could be cursing in public or it could be something else, but it's vocal and motor. And that I believe is what you need for Tourette's. But anyway, this paper on magnesium and Tourette's was saying a huge reason why magnesium is so important for preventing or getting rid of kind of or helping people with Tourette's syndrome, their tics, right? That's what they call them, TIC, is magnesium. But the paper was called Magnesium and Tourette's Syndrome or something like that. But a lot of the time they talk about magnesium and vitamin B6 because they said, listen, without magnesium, without vitamin B6, and they actually said in a low magnesium state, in a magnesium deficiency state, you have a functional B6 deficiency. B6 can't function well without magnesium. So
Wow.
that's why I think they're put together all the time. So it said magnesium and B6 are essential to prevent the production of these really toxic things like quinolinic acid for the brain. So that's like, there's lots of evidence that magnesium and B6 are really good for all these things. And it's really interesting because another thing that increases tryptophan becoming these bad things like the quinolinic acid is actually estrogen. And Ray Peet once talked about how progesterone can help improve the enzyme that turns tryptophan to niacin, so the good pathway. So progesterone might be, this might be another reason why progesterone can be really useful for depression, anxiety, and other things, and epilepsy, of course, because, well, quinolinic acid and these things are shown to be high when people are convulsing. They're pro-convulsant. They make you seize. They make you have seizures. Progesterone is known to help seizures. Probably a lot of the reasons because progesterone by itself can be anti-seizure. Progesterone can turn into allopregnanolone, which is anti-seizure. But progesterone can help prevent indirectly the production of things that increase seizures. And estrogen can increase the seizures via the quinolinic acid, whatever. So B6 and magnesium are important. Progesterone is important. Estrogen depletes B6 a lot. And that's why people, some smarter doctors, if they have their patients on birth control estrogen, they might say, hey, you might want to take some B6. That's an advice of a doctor that, is good. A lot of doctors will just say, oh, you're fine. You make the estrogen. So what's the problem of taking some more for birth control? And they won't even mention the B6.
Good,
So
but not good enough to not prescribe birth control.
B6 and magnesium, it's not just because of the glutamate to GABA thing is huge. The curanine pathway thing is huge, but why is the curanine pathway so huge? Well, I alluded to earlier, one of the ways we have too much glutamate, we have this thing called NMDA. It's like N-methyl D-aspartate. All you need to know is you have something called NMDA. When it's activated, you make glutamate and other things, but the main issue is glutamate. So you might be thinking, okay, if NMDA is activated, and we have more glutamate and we don't want more glutamate if you have one of these issues. Oh, and by the way, this can include PMS. It doesn't have to be like, ADHD or OCD, like these, big labels. You can have PMS, you can be moody, you can be a little anxious, you can be a little depressed or whatever. Like, you don't need to have some named thing that, is treatable or something. Glutamate seems to be high in a lot of these behavioral mood things. So what activates NMDA? A lot of things, but one of them is actually a very potent activator of NMDA is actually quinolinic acid. So B6 lowers glutamate directly by turning it to GABA, but it also prevents quinolinic acid from being produced, and quinolinic acid activates NMDA, which leads to more glutamate. So B6 is a potent anti-glutamate guy from lots of different directions. Magnesium lowers glutamate. Why? Because there's a few things you can take that are NMDA antagonists. They prevent it from being activated, thus they prevent excess glutamate. Magnesium is an NMDA antagonist. Zinc is an NMDA antagonist, and something called agmatine, which I'll talk about in a bit, it's an amino acid. Agmatine is also an NMDA antagonist. There's lots of drugs that are NMDA antagonists that you need prescription for, and their use is pretty cool. Memantine is an NMDA antagonist, and it's probably, I think it's the one of the only like FDA approved drugs, one of them, for Alzheimer's dementia. They give these people memantine, and memantine, if you search up what is the mechanism of action for memantine, NMDA antagonist, thus memantine lowers glutamate, and they give this to dementia patients, so that should tell you something about glutamate. Ketamine, which is the horse tranquilizer,
Oh,
there's lots
ketamine.
of talk now about special K ketamine being used for like incurable depression. And well, ketamine is like an extremely potent NMDA blocker. Like, I think memantine kind of inhibits it. Magnesium, zinc, agmatine, obviously they're not going to completely block it. They have some good blocking activity. Ketamine, I think, is probably the most potent around, or if not the most, one of the most. So obviously you need like prescriptions and stuff to do that. I don't think ketamine's even approved like memantine is, but I just brought that up to bring home the point. Glutamate can be really harmful. Depression, anxiety, you name it. NMDA is one way we get glutamate. So I don't think people need to go and run away and eat foods that have no glutamine, because I don't think the actual amino acid glutamine is a huge driver of this glutamate. I think it's this NMDA activation. Another thing that activates NMDA is actually ammonia. And Georgie in our last podcast, Maintain Your Brain, was saying, well, one of the reasons lithium is so good for bipolar, Alzheimer's, mania, whatever, depression, lithium is a potent ammonia chelator. Well, Ceylon cinnamon, it turns into something called sodium benzoate, I believe. And Ceylon cinnamon has been studied for Alzheimer's too. We should have brought this up last episode. I guess I forgot, but Ceylon cinnamon, it chelates ammonia, and it's been shown to be good for dementia and stuff. So if you have high ammonia, you could take lithium, sure. You could take Ceylon cinnamon, maybe like a gram or two as a capsule. If you don't want to, you don't have a good source to eat it every day, whatever, you can take it as a supplement. But the main way we get rid of ammonia, and again, ammonia activates NMDA, ammonia leads to more glutamate. So we wouldn't want a lot of ammonia, and a lot of ammonia is harmful for the kidneys. The main way the body gets rid of ammonia is actually you get carbon dioxide and ammonia, they combine, and then you create urea. The main way we make carbon dioxide is actually oxidizing glucose well. If you use glucose well in the body, you create ATP, right? Energy, heat, water, and carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide, you might have been told this in high school or something or university that, oh, carbon dioxide is a waste product of energy production. Well, clearly not, because we need carbon dioxide for a lot of things, including getting rid of ammonia. So B1, magnesium, biotin, there's lots of things that are necessary for us to use glucose well. I'm not saying everyone should run out and go and taking B1 and whatever, but if you feel like you're not oxidizing glucose well, and you know, if you're on a super low carb diet and you're oxidizing a lot of fat instead of carbs, you probably have way lower CO2 production, because fat doesn't make CO2 as much as burning carbs for fuel, right? Oxidizing carbs for fuel. So being a good glucose burner, good glucose oxidizer is very important for CO2. CO2 is very important for getting rid of ammonia. And there's a study, I won't talk about CO2 more after this, it's kind of a tangent, but CO2 has been used, like literally inhaling CO2. Don't do that at home though. It needs to be at a specific ratio with oxygen, but CO2 has been used for anxiety and depression because it's shown to inhibit thromboxanes, which is an eicosanoid, and thromboxanes really increase noradrenaline, or it's also called norepinephrine, I should say. So, and norepinephrine has been shown to be a really causative in like depression and PTSD and stuff. So, lowering thromboxanes via making more CO2 is a way to be antidepressant. So,
Hang
yeah,
on,
do you
let
have any
me.
questions?
Yeah, so I'm so many. And just connections that I made in my head. So, let's start backwards. The urea production, of course, is excreted at the kidneys and becomes urine, right? And that's why there's an ammonia smell to urine, is because we're excreting the ammonia from our bodies. And it's also why they say take lots of cinnamon if you are pre-diabetic or diabetic, because it helps to for you to regulate blood sugar, which is really cool. And so I just made all those little connections. And then I'm going to go all the way back to the beginning, which is just for people who are brand new. Glutamate, a lot of times people, you'll recognize this excitotoxin as MSG. What is monosodium glutamate?
Yeah, so MSG is a direct dietary source of glutamate. So if you have these issues, like if your kid has a nervous tic, the last thing you should do is give him anything with MSG. And you got to look at your soup cans and all these. The MSG is in quite a, you know, it's less, it's in less food now, but it's in Chinese takeout food. It's in probably in a lot of takeout food. It's in soups. And MSG is a direct source of glutamate. So you don't forget about the B6, getting rid of your own glutamate. Like you're giving yourself glutamate when you eat like packaged noodles or whatever. So
And they can
it is
just
harmful.
they and because it became such a taboo food for a while, MSG, they're allowed to call it other things now. Like they lobbied to have the name changed, so it can be found as yeast extract. It can be found as even natural flavors can fall under MSG. I can't remember all of them right now, but if you Google MSG and other names for MSG, you'll find what that is. And an excitotoxin is exactly that. It's something that's toxic that excites the brain and excites. So when I was working with this autistic community, and well, now they're just calling it the spectrum disorder community, they were all sensitive, whether it was worsening of tics, or it was fits of rage, nausea, histamine responses. Even, well, I remember when I was a kid, I would get it as well. Just any kind of MSG would set me off. Now, the other thing is, it can also be produced naturally. Like sometimes it just is made naturally. Like when you make a bone broth, glutamate is a byproduct, or is a it's a conversion that happens when you slow cook bones and gelatin and glutamine, right? Because that's what's in the collagen and the stuff that's in bones. Can you speak just a little more on that?
Yeah, I mean, if you're very, very sensitive, like if you have a severe disorder and your doctor wants to put you on medication for it, because there's some really low levels of, let you know, you can have a minor, your kid could have like a minor tic, or your kid could have some minor OCD. Your doctor will most likely say, hey, like if you can, if the kid can handle it, you should probably just leave him be and hope he gets better. Because for something like tic or Tourette's, the drug is a neuroleptic, which is the new term for antipsychotic, and they have terrible side effects. And if you have OCD, the drug of choice is an SSRI, which is terrible side effects, especially for little children. So if you're at that level where the doctor is saying, hey, these medications are really harmful, but I still think it'd be a good idea for you to go on it, you probably have a pretty severe issue. Then you want to avoid dietary glutamate for sure, because you're clearly having a big issue with it internally. And if you're adding more externally, that can be harmful. So going on a low glutamine, low glutamate diet, which can include avoiding things like bone broth, would probably be useful for them. But if you have like minor ADHD, or if you have a minor anxiety or a little bit of PMS, I don't think worrying about glutamate or glutamine in food is a huge deal. I think you should focus on making sure you have enough B6 consumption, magnesium consumption, which could be from food, but if you're a little more, you know, you have a little more issues than a normal bad day or whatever, then you probably might look into supplementation. But anyway, you want to make sure everything's cool inside, getting rid of that glutamate, turning it into GABA. You probably don't need to worry about like the you know, the whatever food you're eating for glutamine. But yeah, like I said, if you're severe and your doctor's thinking of putting you on drugs, then you should probably do everything you can to kind of keep that glutamate low, keep that GABA high, because that's going to keep you, you know, less irritable and all that stuff.
So what about the healing properties? So it sounds a lot like a lot of things, whereas it can be a cure and it can be a poison, right? So I have known many people, including myself, who have had great benefit from gut healing, leaky gut, using bone broth. But people who have SIBO go bonkers with it. It can really irritate and inflame and worsen SIBO. So is it the glutamate that we're talking about that's not getting this conversion that's perhaps ultimately aggravating the SIBO? Do you know what I mean?
It could be. And also, but the good thing about bone broth is, it has a lot of glycine, and while glycine, everyone knows, it's pro-calming, you can increase GABA, that's good. But another thing glycine does, I don't think a lot of your viewers might know this, but glutathione is a tripeptide. It's made of three different amino acids. Glutamic acid, which is, you know, either one step above or one step below glutamine. It's related to glutamine. Cysteine and glycine. So one way to lower glutamate is actually take its, you know, substrate, take its raw material, glutamine, glutamic acid, and turn it into other things. So if you're eating more glycine and cysteine, the third, you know, musketeer in that, you know, trio to make glutathione is glutamine, glutamic acid. So if you get those three together and you're making more glutathione, you have less glutamine, glutamic acid for glutamate. So in a roundabout way, eating more glycine can help indirectly lower glutamate levels. But if you're getting issues eating it, it could be irritating your stomach. It could be part of the glutamine part. It could be, I think people say collagen in bone broth is high in histamine. It could be any of those things. So it's not necessarily from the glutamate, but it could be.
The histamine makes more sense. Okay, and then here's my big question, more of a oh brain bomb than a question. So, okay. If we talked about the GABA pathway and we talked about the glutamate working on the GABA pathway, is that what you
Yeah,
said?
it's glutamate and then GABA. That's the.
Glutamate and then GABA. So we know something else that works on the GABA pathway, and that's progesterone.
Progesterone, allopregnant alone is even stronger. So, and that comes from progesterone.
Right, it's metabolite of progesterone. I am thinking, I mean, it's kind of obvious now that you say it, but magnesium deficiency could be the obvious reason that someone doesn't do well with progesterone, because I don't know if it would inhibit absorption or just inhibit it from becoming GABA. Do you know what I mean? Like they're, I mean, Morley Robbins talks about this all the time. He's like, yeah, you know, I mean, we need B6 and magnesium to even just make progesterone, let alone absorb supplemental and have it go down the right pathways, right?
Oh yeah, and you just reminded me too. Like I only talked about two things B6 and magnesium do. Another reason why B6 is so useful, especially for PMS fertility, right? But a lot of like if you search up vitamins for fertility, you'll probably find B6 and vitamin E are like the top two. B6 can, because you just said it's important to make progesterone. Well, B6 is really important for making dopamine, and thus it actually lowers prolactin quite well. It's one of the few over-the-counter things that science even admits does lower prolactin. We got B6, zinc, and vitamin E. Prolactin is really, really increased by estrogen in my, our friend Danny Roddy often says it's way more useful to test prolactin in the blood than any of the estrogens, right? Estrone, estradiol, estriol, whatever. Because he says if prolactin's high, it's a great surrogate for estrogen levels. If you have really high prolactin, so if you're a woman and your prolactin's above 13, if you're a man and your prolactin's above 7, and obviously we're not talking about breastfeeding or anything, because then obviously prolactin will be at different levels when you're breastfeeding. Then you can pretty much assume your estrogen's high. Estrogen directly increases prolactin. So I think vitamin E works to decrease prolactin via being an estrogen antagonist. Zinc and V6 probably lower prolactin by increasing dopamine, because prolactin and dopamine are the opposites. Actually, a lot of these conditions, I think, wrongly associate high dopamine with, like, I don't know, schizophrenia or something. I don't think that's true. I think high catecholamines in general, which dopamine is one of them, can be implicated in schizophrenia, but I think it's wrong to just say dopamine is the cause of whatever, schizophrenia or bipolar. I don't think that's true at all. But because of this wrong assumption, you use neuroleptics, antipsychotics, and what do antipsychotics do? They lower dopamine by increasing prolactin. And the main effect of these, like haloperidol or antipsychotic drug, is you gain a lot of weight, men start lactating, you get depressed. They're terrible drugs, and I think they often don't even work. Like for Tourette's, they often don't even work, and they're the only like thing that's, approved for it. So a lot of the time the doctors just say just live with it, because you might not get any benefit and you're gonna have a really terrible time on these drugs. But they work, quote unquote, by lowering dopamine because they increase prolactin. B6, and it's really funny because B6 is actually used for so many neurological conditions, including schizophrenia. And B6 is basically the opposite of an antipsychotic. It lowers prolactin and increases dopamine. So, how do you make sense of that? Ticks are shown to be benefit. People with ticks benefit from B6, but the drug they're using acts opposite to B6, right? So B6 is, I don't want to act like I'm too obsessed with B6, because obviously all the B vitamins are important. And I myself will often, if I'm taking B6 for different reasons, I'll often take like a B complex too, just to get the other Bs. Or I try to make sure I'm eating like liver and eggs, which have a bunch of B vitamins. But I do think some additional isolated B6 can be really helpful for a lot of different people with different issues. And yeah, it increases GABA, lowers glutamate, it decreases quinolinic acid, it decreases prolactin. There's so many benefits of the B6, and I just wanted to bring it up because you said, oh, it helps increase progesterone. Well, it also lowers prolactin and increases dopamine, and it's important for a lot of different things. But what you said about magnesium progesterone, I mean, I have lots of quotes that say a lot of things don't work as they're supposed to in a magnesium deficiency. They just don't work. So you can take progesterone, And it might not work, not necessarily because of absorption or something. Maybe the magnesium deficiency just doesn't allow the good effects of progesterone to be felt, you know? Because the one paper I was reading yesterday said, in a magnesium deficiency, you have like a functional B6 deficiency. Like B6 isn't doing what it should be doing. Could be the same with progesterone. So magnesium is important. And I don't think, listen, I think taking magnesium pills, like magnesium taurate and glycinate, I use Lifeblood personally for that. A lot of people talk about magnesium 3 and 8. You know, I think they can be helpful, but it doesn't seem like they're super, super, you know, well absorbed, especially in someone really deficient in magnesium. That might not be enough. So I think they're good, but if you can get magnesium in lots of ways, I think that might be better. So you can take a magnesium capsule. You can drink magnesium water. It's called magnesium bicarbonate. I make my own. All you need is carbonated water and magnesium, I think some magnesium powder.
Lifeblood sells that powder, right?
Lifeblood sells the powder, yeah.
And they sell the magnesium that you like also.
Yeah, Mag Plus is the capsules, and then magnesium bicarbonate powder, I guess, is the other one.
And what form is the Mag Plus?
Mag Plus is taurate and glycinate, which have been shown in one study to like greatly improve depression by itself, like those two forms. Mm. And by the way, for a lot of these issues like tics, ADHD, OCD, glycine and taurine have been shown to help. Magnesium taurate and magnesium glycinate is magnesium with taurine and with glycine. So by taking Lifeblood Mag Plus, you're getting some taurine, you're getting some magnesium, you're getting some glycine, you're getting all three. Georgie makes a product called Magnol. It's magnesium with DMSO. It's used topically. And he's talked about how it really helps to increase magnesium levels in the body. It really absorbed well, so that might be an option. Magnesium baths are an option. So if you have severe, or not even not severe, if you have a mild OCD or ADHD or something, getting magnesium in lots of different ways is probably going to be really beneficial. But you know what Danny Roddy, Ray Peet, and George Dinkoff would say? You can't hold on to magnesium if you're hypothyroid. You need to magnesium to stay bound to ATP. You need to have good thyroid levels. You need good T3.
I mean,
you need
that's
good thyroid
just
function.
Awful.
Yeah.
That's
so,
just awful.
Yeah. But it should be a little hopeful because, you know, if you have been doing everything I just said, you're like, oh, I can't believe, you know, I've been taking the magnesium pills. I've been drinking the water. I've been, you know, bathing in magnesium every day. And, it, you know, I still have all these issues. You should, you know, there's some hope. And, well, maybe you can't really retain it because you're hypothyroid. So now you have a new direction. Because if you were trying to fix your, let's just say OCD, and you've been trying the magnesium route, if you've, you know, if you've expired that route, like you've done as much as you can, it's time to move on and find a different solution. And if your solution is you can't retain the magnesium, you got to work on the thyroid route. And I'm not saying you have to take thyroid, but you need to do some things to improve your thyroid conversion. We've talked about this so many episodes. You could just go and find them. Progesterone could be one way, right? Like there's so many ways to improve your thyroid conversion and production. Even eating things like oysters and shrimp, right, with their nutrients, like their minerals, eating more carbohydrates like potatoes and apples, right? Lots of things to do in your thyroid stuff. But if you're a hypothyroid person, it's probably not very useful to take magnesium. So the hope is now you have a new avenue to go and get your magnesium levels up by increasing your thyroid function.
Right.
And I also wanted to read this one little quote here, though, because you mentioned irritability with spectrum disorder and stuff. This quote says, hyperirritability, inattention, and abnormal head movements can be associated with pyridoxine deficiency. That's a vitamin B6 deficiency. Then it goes, vitamin B6 deficiency causes increased magnesium excretion, leading to negative magnesium balance, further compromising a magnesium deficit. So I just said thyroid is important to keep magnesium up. That quote just said B6 is important to keep magnesium from being excreted. So if you're, and again, all these different behavioral stuff in the clinical trials, they use both. So if your magnesium is not working, you might need more B6. You might need more thyroid function. You know, don't just end your journey at magnesium. It's important, but there's other things you got to look at, even to do with magnesium, right? Like the
Right.
B6.
What's
Yeah.
interesting also is I think about all the people who take B vitamins and have and either don't feel anything. In fact, I had sent this question in to I guess Danny had Chris Master John on, and I had sent this question in, and I never listened to the podcast. I haven't had a chance
Danny didn't
to.
ask any of the questions. He will in the future. So
Okay,
he
because
didn't ask any of it.
one of my questions was, you know, what about people who take supplements and don't seem to feel anything? They have no, now I know that can be a lot about malabsorption at the gut, but also these conversions that need to happen. And, you know, also when you take something like B6, if you don't have the you know, magnesium. And then they get maybe they'll get strange reactions from B vitamins. And I'm not talking about people with MTHFR and stuff like that, although it probably includes them, where they're like, I have to have methylfolates or I can't have methylfolates or whatever it may be. These strange reactions to B6 sound like the same thing if you don't take enough magnesium. Then the B6 not only is not going to do anything, but it might even do something bad. It might even convert to something that might make you feel bad, right? Like we talk about different conversions that maybe make you sleepy or make you dizzy or whatever. And so it really gives more light or it sheds light on people who have reactions when they take supplements. It's like, gosh,
Yeah,
we
and Georgie even told me once, we were talking about B6 for a while, because Georgie has a great, if you guys type in vitamin B6, Hey Dude, you'll see his blog. He has a, it'll show you every article or blog where B6 is mentioned. And one of the more recent ones is vitamin B6 can like have a very strong therapeutic effect on anxiety and depression. And he goes into explaining why, because of glutamate and GABA and stuff like that. But I asked Georgie some stuff about B6, and he was telling me that he's tried 50 milligrams before and he didn't like it. He felt some negative effect. I don't remember what it was. Maybe a little, I don't know what it was. I shouldn't say off, you know, I shouldn't make it up, but he didn't like 50 milligrams. He prefers 15, 1.5, personally. But I'm pretty sure Georgie doesn't have, you know, I'm guessing, but I'm sure he doesn't, I'm pretty sure he doesn't have like ADHD or OCD or Tourette's or. I don't think he's autistic or, you know, other things like that.
doesn't have
So
severe
he
deficiencies.
doesn't, yeah, and he obviously doesn't have PMS. He's not a woman or anything, you know. So like maybe 15 milligrams is perfect for Georgie. But like I said, in the study with ADHD kids, they took 50. Who knew, who knows, for 2 months every day without any negative side effects, only positives. But who knows? Maybe the minimum effective dose was 30 milligrams, and every milligram above 30 was doing nothing. Nothing bad, nothing good. Who knows? It's unfortunate because most of the capsules you can buy with isolated P5P are 50. I think some sell 25. I think 50 is a fine dose for most people. But if you want to go on the lower side, buy a 25 milligram one or take a 50 and cut it in half and take one a. You know, half a day, or maybe take 50 every other day. But when you say people don't feel much with, like, let's take Lifeblood. Great energy plus is the B vitamin. Great product. But if you're taking it for a good amount of B6, two capsules get you 10 milligrams. For some people, like, let's say Georgie Dinko, I mean, let's say you, Kitty, 10 milligrams might be all you need from that B6. You take the Lifeblood, you take all your 8 Bs, and you're great. But if someone is, you know, cursing in public because they have Tourette's and they don't want to be doing that, they want to get better, 10 milligrams is, in my mind, probably not going to cut it at all. So if they add 50 milligrams on top of that Lifeblood 10 and they're getting 60 milligrams, I don't even think that's too much for them, especially if they don't feel much right away. Give yourself some time. Like these studies I've talked about, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, they're not done in a week. But if you're not feeling anything from 10 milligrams and you have an issue, you should try more, I think. I think. I mean, you know, obviously I'm not giving anyone advice or anything. I'm not telling you what to do. But
It makes
I
just
bite
like
my
scratch my
nails and
heart.
stuff, which I bite my nails and stuff, which is, I guess some people call it a grooming disorder. It's a type of OCD, they say, right? I'm, you know, not to put a label on it or anything, but I'm trying out 50 milligrams of B6 a day to see if I can be stronger at resisting the urge to bite my nails, right? Because it's not something I want to do, but it's something I find very difficult to stop. And a lot of you that don't bite your nails might be thinking, just stop. But it's, you know,
A
it's not,
compulsion.
yeah, it's a kind of, it's a compulsion. It's not that easy. So if I think some B6 will help me, I'm going to try it out. I think there's a lot of good evidence, a lot of good mechanistic evidence that it should help. Because if I'm biting my nails because I have high glutamate, low GABA, because I have a bad curanine pathway where I'm leading to high quinolinic acid, if I have high, I don't think prolactin would be involved in it, but let's say I have, maybe I have prolactin that could be lower. I think I'm willing to experiment with some B6 personally. And if you have a kid that convulses, right, has seizures, if you have a kid that is kind of a trouble in school, the teachers are telling you, like, hey, like maybe you should get him on Ritalin or something. Well, B6 might change your child. It might change yourself. If, you know, because a lot of these things we're talking about right now are really catastrophic for children, but they're not children diseases. Like adults can have ADHD, right? But it's hard to talk about the children having it because you don't want to medicate the child, or you don't want the child to have a rough time in school. So ADHD is not like a kid thing, but you know, it's more, mothers care about their kids more than themselves, right? So they want, you know, they want to find something that can help their kid with ADHD maybe more than even themselves with ADHD. But B6 should help anyone. It's not kid specific. But yeah, I do want to talk about one other thing though, agmatine,
Hang on
before I
one
forget.
second. Okay, but wait, let
Yeah.
me back up for also just to keep this remind everyone that something that depletes the body's ability to even to make B6 and actually makes you deep B6 dependent while you're on it is medicated birth control, which really is just estrogens, you know,
Any type of
progesterone
estrogen.
estrogens. Yeah. And I'm going to go as far as to say there are other medications that do the same. I don't know what they are, but I've heard it, I've read it, and so I just don't know what they are. Probably a lot of them make you B6 dependent.
And you know what? That just reminded me. I have a Ray book open. It's called Nutrition for Women, which I think everyone can find for free now. I think you have to do some clicking, but you can find all of Ray's books for free now, but on the internet. But Nutrition for Women is cool because he talks a lot about nutrients, more so than the other books. The other books he talks a lot about, he does talk about nutrients like vitamin A, but a lot about hormones. Nutrition for Women talks about nutrients. And there's some B6 quotes. A lot of people have been telling me they get acne when they have milk. This is a cool quote. Milk is a rich natural source of tryptophan. Since tryptophan promotes the formation of serotonin, which stimulates release of prolactin, and prolactin activates the formation of sebum oil by the skin, large amounts of milk could promote a tendency toward acne when there's a deficiency of B6, thyroid, or progesterone. So, maybe if you drink some milk and have acne, my advice would be to switch to goat milk because I think the A1 is causing the acne. But you know, even if you're getting it from goat milk, or let's say you want to keep drinking cow milk, you won't have goat. Maybe some B6 will get rid of that milk-induced acne if you're dealing with milk-induced acne. You know, a lot of people can drink milk fine, but you know, B6 is just so versatile. Lowers prolactin, increases glutamate, it decreases glutamate, increases GABA. Like the other B vitamins are great, obviously, but when we're coming to behavioral stuff, I don't think there's a nutrient that's better. Like, I mean, they can all help, but I mean, it's like therapeutic, like at the clinical level. Like they're using it to really help people. And I feel really bad for kids with issues. I feel, you know, it really breaks my heart hearing about children suffering of something. And especially because no one really cares as much when you're an adult and they, you know, a doctor says take this drug and you know, take it or not, whatever, like, you know, it's, you're an adult. But people, there's just something that doesn't sit well for them medicating a kid, especially when the doctors are like, can your kid handle the issues he's dealing with? You know, like, you know, it probably would be better than the side effects of the drug. So it sucks because a lot of the doctors will tell these parents, like, their advice is basically like, I could medicate, but it's probably going to make it worse, so just deal with it. That's not useful because now your kid is still suffering. And parents need to find alternative ways that they can help their child. And there's a lot of things, like with ADHD, I think a big root of that is blood sugar imbalance. There's a book called Hypoglycemia. It's Not Your Mind, It's Your Liver by Rhoda Barnes, the same guy that wrote the hyperthyroid book. And he talks about kids will be terrors when their blood sugar is too low for too long. They can't push it back up normally. So there's lots of things you can do about blood sugar. Rhoda Barnes says a thyroid deficiency, so you can be born hypothyroid, he says. So he would treat kids with, they were severely hypothyroid, he would give them, he would treat them for hypothyroidism, and then their hypoglycemia as a result would fix, because you need that good thyroid function to maintain good blood sugar levels. Not too high, not too low. By the way, low blood sugar is way more dangerous than high blood sugar. Low blood sugar can kill you. It can put you in a con it can give you a seizure. Low blood sugar can put you in a coma. High blood sugar is bad in the long run, but the body would prefer, if you give the body two options, have blood sugar above the normal or below, it's going to do whatever it can to keep it above. There are so many hormones that will increase blood sugar. There's very few that will lower it. You know, like the body doesn't want low blood sugar. And if you're having seizures or your kid's having seizures, I would assume at the moment he's convulsing, the blood sugar is probably too low. Like, I'm not saying it's causative, but it's certainly making you more susceptible to that seizure, that convulsion. But anyway, having said all that, there's a
That's
lot of
good.
things to look into, but there's things that can help, like directly. B6, theanine, phosphatidylserine, B1, ginkgo biloba. Like, there's things you can do to help an ADHD kid. Because if you're a mom and said, I am not giving him Ritalin, I'm not giving him amphetamine, you don't want to just do nothing, right? B6 might help, phosphatidylserine might help, whatever, 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 taurine might help. So, you know, I like to give options that have research behind them, and then you can talk about them with your doctor or whatever practitioner and see if it's right for you or your kid. But because B6 might not be right for you, but if it is right for you, it might change your life actually. So,
Yeah,
you know.
that was good. That was really good.
Yeah. Do you want me to talk about Agmatine, or do you have a question?
Agmatine, no, let's do it.
Okay. Agmatine is really cool, and it's for all you people that respect Ray Pete. He was a fan of it at some point, even told Danny about it, so years ago. So it's a Ray Pete approved thing in my books. Agmatine, we make it ourselves, and it comes from arginine, but it acts very different to arginine. Similar to like glutamate and GABA, right? Like glutamate is so different than GABA, but GABA comes from glutamate. It's glutamate is the base of GABA. Just like arginine is the base of agmatine, but agmatine is quite different than arginine. Agmatine can inhibit nitric oxide synthase, so the production of nitric oxide. And this is important. Ray Pete people, including myself, are not fans of increasing nitric oxide. It's a basically a toxin, and its main role is not necessarily good blood flow and vascularity. That it's not a systemic blood flow enhancer. It's used to kill viruses and bacteria and stuff. So if you have a, you know, some germs growing in your nose, it's going to become an infection, or you have a virus growing in your nose, it's going to lead to a viral infection like a cold or a flu. Nitric oxide is produced to kill that. It if it's systemically risen, it prevents energy production by binding to complex four of the electron transport chains. It's called cytochrome C oxidase. One of the only things that could remove it is actually red light. So if you like red light, you don't like nitric oxide, because red light removes nitric oxide from its inhibition on energy production. Nitric oxide, in general, can be very harmful. And I'm not a fan of nitric oxide boosters, like anything with nitrates. People will like try to take things with nitrates, like beetroot, to increase nitric oxide. I think that's a harmful thing to do. But anyway, having said all that.
But wait, no, but wait. But we do need it It is something that
Definitely.
our body uses as a tool to disinfect, it sounds like,
Definitely. And
but
other things. Yeah.
and other things. But and if you have low levels of nitric oxide, should you supplement?
I currently am not convinced someone would have an issue with that. If they're having blood flow issues, Ray Peet would always talk about how carbon dioxide is the systemic blood flow enhancer. Nitric oxide is not a systemic blood flow enhancer. It can increase blood flow, and people take Viagra or whatever, but people take Viagra are harming themselves. I think they're harming their heart and other things. Like, if you want better blood flow, there's lots of things you can do. And increasing CO2 by, increasing the oxidation of glucose, maybe B1, different things can help you directly increase CO2,
Well,
would help with the blood flow.
people take it for pre-workout. There's even
Yeah.
products called No
Arginine,
Explode,
citrulline.
like
Yep.
nitric
And
oxide
here's this
explode.
here's the sad thing. Agmatine, if you buy it, it's sold as a nitric oxide booster, but it actually does the opposite. At least in certain areas. Like, there's different studies. You can search up, like, if you listeners are interested, go to PubMed or Google Scholar and type agmatine and then autism or agmatine OCD, like agmatine ADHD. There's lots of evidence that can be very helpful with all these things. And agmatine does a lot of things. So it inhibits nitric oxide synthase in different areas, like in the brain. So it lowers nitric oxide in the brain. And it was shown to be really, like, they had really good effects with it. And then they gave arginine, and all the effects, the positive effects, were gone. So arginine blocked the positive effects of agmatine. Arginine increases nitric oxide pretty reliably. Agmatine seems to lower its synthesis in certain areas. So that's one benefit. But I think a huge benefit of agmatine is it's a pretty strong NMDA antagonist. We already talked about NMDA. Magnesium and zinc block it, which would help lower glutamate. B6 lowers quinolinic acid, which would, quinolinic acid activates NMDA. So B6 helps indirectly lower NMDA activation, glutamate. Anything that lowers ammonia will lower glutamate by preventing ammonia activating NMDA. Agmatine is another thing that you can take to block NMDA. The thing is, though, agmatine competes with absorption with other amino acids like arginine. So if you're going to take it, first of all, it tastes terrible, like really bad. And it doesn't dissolve well in cold, so you need it in hot. So I put it in like hot coffee and I just drink it when I take it. And I take it away from food with protein. So maybe 30 minutes before I eat anything, maybe an hour or two after eating anything, specifically the protein. And agmatine has been shown to really help with a lot of these behavioral things. And I think a big part of it is that lowering glutamate via NMDA. Oh, agmatine has been used for benzodiazepine withdrawal. You can
No
actually
way.
type in NMDA benzodiazepine. Even Google will probably bring you, because that's a really popular one. NMDA can help people with the withdrawal of benzodiazepines. And I think, what's his name? Jordan Peterson, who was a teacher at the university I'm currently at, University of Toronto, he has said getting off benzodiazepines was a terrible, like, experience that almost killed him. Agmatine, it seems like one of the few things that actually help with this. And I think the study said agmatine helps with benzodiazepine withdrawal by modulating glutamate GABA. So it's lowering that glutamate, increasing that GABA, which benzos kind of screwed up for you. Agmatine is trying to fix that and help you withdraw safer and maybe a little more stably. So agmatine is really useful. I think it's been shown to be an anticonvulsant as well. So if you have, well, and obviously, right, because glutamate increases seizures, anything that lowers glutamate, anything that antagonizes NMDA should help with seizures. Agmatine's been shown to help with seizures. B6 help with seizures, magnesium seizures, progesterone,
Progesterone.
like all these things. Yeah, progesterone, of course. So agmatine is cool, and a lot of people don't talk about it. Like
I've never
I
heard of
said,
it.
never heard of it, and it's just an amino acid. Like, it's,
I mean, I'm
yeah.
sure I've heard of it in my studies, but I just didn't retain that info.
And here's another thing cool with agmatine. So I said that for like Tourette's or tic disorders, one of the only like approved drugs are these antipsychotics and neuroleptics. But There are like off-label drugs that some doctors will use, especially in Europe. And one of them is actually the antihypertensive drug clonidine. And clonidine works through different mechanisms. One of them is actually lowering noradrenaline and adrenaline. So clearly the catecholamines are involved. It's not just glutamate, because glutamate's not a catecholamine. Catecholamines like adrenaline, noradrenaline, I know dopamine's a catecholamine, but I don't think it's very involved in a negative way. But catecholamines seem to contribute to behavioral disorders. Clonidine has been shown to be pretty effective in getting rid of tics in young children. Well, agmatine has been shown to act similar to clonidine. I think it does something. It agonizes like the alpha 2 receptor. Oh, that's not necessarily important for the average listener. If you want, you can type in agmatine, clonidine, and there is a paper showing that they do similar things. Clonidine is a prescription drug that can have side effects, obviously. Pretty low compared to like an antipsychotic, though. But agmatine is an over-the-counter amino acid that seems to be really useful for OCD, ADHD, and other things I mentioned. So magnesium, eating zinc, B6, agmatine, Ceylon cinnamon, like all these things, one way or the other, can help lower glutamate, increase GABA, lower NMDA, improve things like OCD, ADHD, blah, 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 blah. So, I mean, I think a stack, quote unquote, of for a person suffering with one of these, B6, magnesium, agmatine, theanine has been shown to be helpful for a lot of these things, OCD, ADHD, tics, Tourette's. So theanine, taurine, and phosphatidylserine has been used for ADHD. I don't think it's been used for the other things I mentioned, but it might help with OCD. I don't know, but it's only been studied for ADHD, I think, and maybe dementia. It's been shown to be helpful. But all these things, Ceylon cinnamon, they seem like you don't have to take them all. But here's a list of things that might help. And you can search all of them. Like, feel free. PubMed, B6, tic disorder, B6, ADHD. Read it for yourself. A lot of them are actually free. I think the ADHD one is free. The OCD one is the one that Kyle sent me, so that one's not free. But I mean, you can email me and I could send it to you. Maybe I shouldn't have said that, but
I
but
know.
if you guys really want that one, I mean, I have it on my computer. But anyway, yeah, I think a lot of these behavioral and mood things, of course, including, like I said, PMS and other stuff, it doesn't have to be serious, like a su super serious, like diagnosable thing. I think they're pretty much all related in what's causing them. You just might react differently. Like, I think if you have a really mean teacher when you were grade 3 and she really scared you and you developed an OCD compulsion because of that, like, I mean, maybe that led you down that direction instead of the ADHD direction. Maybe you developed a nervous tic because, you went on a trip and you got lost. You couldn't find your parents for a few hours. I don't know, right? Like, but I think they're all have to do with GABA, glutamate dysfunction. This curinine pathway is really big. Like, you want that tryptophan becoming nice, and you don't want quinolinic acid. It's a known neurotoxin, right? And I have to say again, B6 for various mechanisms is just shown to have. Like, when if you ask anyone, how can I lower quinolinic acid? It's B6 and magnesium. Like, that's the two things, right? It's not a very well-known pathway, but a mother recently commented on a Facebook post I made in your group, and she said, I don't know what the Oats test is. I probably should, but she said my son did an Oats test and he had really high quinolinic acid and he was suffering with something. So, if you want to be able to tell, do you have this high quinolinic acid? It looks like this, whatever Oats test can be
Yeah,
useful.
it's the organic acids test. It's on the Dutch.
Does the Dutch show quinolinic acid?
Hang on, I'm looking at finding a good description, or hang on, I'll edit this later. Let me see. Yeah, basically organic acids are, of course, you can test them through urine. They're excreted at the urine. There we go. I'll show you
Okay, cool.
exactly what's
So
on.
that
Okay.
might be something you want to do before you take Vuzix. If you really want to be stringent, do an OATS test, see if your quinolinic acid's high, right?
Oh,
Maybe then
it's
you
not
need
on
more Vuzix.
here. It's not on here. It's B12, B6. So it's B12, methylmalonate, B6, xanthronate, and kynurate,
Oh,
glutathione marker.
chiurinate, is that KYN?
Yeah.
Okay, kynurate is part of that chirionine pathway, so that would be useful to test.
The glutathione marker is pyroglutamate. The biotin marker, oh, so interesting because they didn't have these before, is called indican. It's a potential gut putrefaction or dysbiosis is if it's high.
Yep, because Chris Masterton talked about how high protein diets can increase your need for biotin because of that putrefaction. So that's
Interesting.
interesting why you mentioned that. That's part of the biotin test.
Probably need higher HCL or to takes HCL when you have a higher protein diet. At least I always recommend animal protein diet. Okay, dopamine metabolite is a homovanillate. Norepinephrine metabolite is the vanomandylate. I'm butchering these, I'm sure. Oh, and you'll find this interesting. Neuroinflammation marker is quinolinate.
Quinolinate, yeah, okay, that's related to quinolinic acid. So quinolinate would be a useful thing to test if your kid is suffering with something that we mentioned in this podcast. An OATS test might be a cool thing to see his markers or her markers. I say he because tic disorders are high for kids, but I mean girls can get them too. They can get ADHD, whatever, right? So,
Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, there, I think along the lines of tics are also, and Tourette's along the lines are, like really mild things would be like leg shaking, finger tapping, nail biting, hair pulling, cutting,
The
all
hair
these.
pulling, the hair pulling and the nail biting aren't specifically tics because they're all part of this grooming disorder thing, like trichotillomania or something is like hair twirling. But you're right about the feet and stuff, like those can definitely be tics.
But I mean, I'm not saying it's a tic. I'm just saying it seems to fall under the same category of like obsessive compulsive disorder
Yeah,
of
definitely. They're all OCD things.
compulsions. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
But
then the
tics are like
last
a
two.
really specific thing. Like, but I should say before you, when you have a kid with a tic or an adult with Tourette's or whatever, it's a really high likelihood that they will either have ADHD or OCD with it. Like tics usually come with something else. So yeah, you can have a tic and you're pulling out your hair or twirling your hair because you have tic with OCD or tic with ADHD would be. That's a really tough one because they say amphetamines worsen tics, and that's what they give kids with ADHD. So what do you do then? But
Wow.
you're right. When you have a tic,
Complicated.
it's very likely to have either ADHD or OCD with that. So it comes with other disorders. They pack on.
It's so fascinating. And then there's just melatonin in this OATS test, which is measured as a 6-OH melatonin sulfate. And then the oxidative stress is measured as 8-hydroxy 2-deoxygenase. Anyway, 8-OHDG. That's interesting because if it's an excretion, if you're excreting this oxidative stress marker or this melatonin, right? Like I was telling you how high I see melatonin in a lot of people on the Dutch, and it's really high. I mean, I've seen it like out of range and often, but these people aren't sleeping well. Now, I know that just because you have insomnia doesn't mean that you don't have good melatonin production. It's almost always an insulin resistance, liver insomnia type of thing when people have, and cortisol thing when people have it. I know this is slightly off of the rail, but just looking at this OATS test right here, when people have super high melatonin and they're not taking it, they're not supplementing it, I wonder, and it is an antioxidant, we know, but that paper that you sent me the other day was shocking, you know,
Yeah,
because it.
the paper said high melatonin is a risk factor for schizophrenia. So, you know,
So
that's
the levels up to schizophrenia would include depression and mood swings and all those things that, you know,
bipolar mania.
bipolar. So like when they have really high melatonin, you know, this particular person's test that I'm looking at right here, this person battles severely with anxiety and very deep levels of depression, but she'll go in and out of it. But I was really shocked to see that, and I keep seeing it.
Well, you know what might be helpful for this person? So, tryptophan, ideally, when we don't have a really abnormally or inappropriate high levels of estrogen, inappropriate levels of inflammation, and when we have good B6 and magnesium status, as Chris Masterjohn would say, he says status every time he talks about like levels of vitamins. You take tryptophan and turn it into niacin. Another way that we can use tryptophan is you turn tryptophan into serotonin and then melatonin. And if this person's having really high melatonin and she's depressed and is anxious, maybe, just maybe, her tryptophan is not being shuttled into the niacin pathway. It's shuttled into the other pathways, serotonin, melatonin, curinate, quinolinic acid. So maybe some B6 and magnesium for a couple weeks, maybe 2 months, would lower the melatonin, would improve the anxiety. And I'm not saying, like, I don't want to scare people for melatonin, but I'm just saying if you have high melatonin, well, it comes from, at some point, it comes from tryptophan. And if your tryptophan is doing weird things, B6 is what's you and magnesium is used to fix it.
Wow. I mean,
And
let's.
B2.
I want to wrap this up now, because I know it's a lot for people to hear, but I think this is a really important episode. One of the things that stands out to me right now that I just said wow about was the more inflammation, the more stress, the more oxidative stress that we have in the body.
Estrogen.
Yeah, so that includes the more estrogen, you know, and lack of magnesium, you know, mineral deficiencies or mineral dysregulation, vitamin deficiencies, not good enough food, malabsorption at the gut. These things, you know, it's like our bodies are these huge pathways, have all these pathways, and some are healthy pathways, and some are like the body's just doing what it can pathways, doing it whatever it can to survive pathways. And those pathways are almost always driven by stress and high estrogen and high serotonin and these things,
Inflammation,
inflammation. And so, you know, I learned so much by studying the Dutch because that's exactly what we're looking at because we're watching the excretion in the urine and it with the Dutch. So we see, you can see that these people, thanks to the Dutch, you can see that they're favoring these pathways that are making androgens and DHT and then aromatizing into estrogen. And then when it gets to estrogen, you can see that they're favoring the 16OH pathways and the 4OH pathways that are the dangerous pathways that are associated with, you know, cancer and fibroids and heavy bleeding and all that stuff. It's so interesting. And I heard, let's just wrap it up here because that blew my mind, that little video you sent me of Georgie talking about DIM. And, you know, Dr. Marshall has always said, what had always said to me, DIM, all it does is convert the 16OH pathway to the more beneficial 2OH pathway. So that's the danger, a danger, potentially dangerous metabolite that you're making with estrogen. All it does is convert it to the beneficial. But if you aren't favoring healthy pathways, you're going to send that out into the bowel to get excreted. It's going to get methylated and detox, get into the bowel, and it's going to get recycled right back into the body. And that does not mean that you're going to make good estrogen from it. If you're favoring bad pathways, you can turn estriol into tumors. That's just what your body is doing. So people are like, take estriol, you know, buy estriol, take est, you know, only put estradiol on the labia. It'll stay there. It's like, no, your liver has to metabolize that two passes and then the third level of detoxification at the gut. And if you are favoring unhealthy pathways because of all the things you mentioned in this podcast, this episode, you're just going to turn it right, going to recycle it right back into that dangerous place. So that's one of the reasons I do not recommend estrogen. You've got to get all this stuff you talked about. And this goes for kids too. This isn't just about menopausal women. This is everybody, men
Any
too.
human, yeah.
Any human, prostate cancer, all these things are, we're forcing things, and it sounds like we're forcing amino acids down unhealthy pathways that can make unhealthy things. And we need to go into the root cause and start to address these things: thyroid, liver function, gut health. Yeah, that was really good.
And I think two last things though, I think would be, if you want, it would be useful for this episode. One quick thing, just because you talked about pathways, I'm really convinced a lot of bad issues have to do with, at the very high level, like let's talk about hair loss, PCOS, anxiety, depression. I think at the very high level, not getting into the nitty-gritty of glutamate and all these B6 and stuff, it's, are you driven by your gonads, which are ovaries, testicles, whatever, right? Depending on your gender. Are you driven by your gonads, your liver, and your thyroid? Or are you driven by your pituitary, hypothalamus, and your adrenals, right? The HPTA, right? The hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal axis. Because you're driven by, you, all of them are working all the time. But as Ray Peet would always say, if your thyroid's functioning well, if your liver's functioning well, and your gonads are functioning well, your pituitary and adrenals don't have much to do. If your pituitary is pumping prolactin, pumping FSH, pumping out LH, then there's something wrong. And people might say, well, you need LH to make testosterone. Well, you need a little bit. If you're pumping out tons of LH, your gonads as a male aren't responding. That's why there's lots of it. If your TSH is from the pituitary, if your thyroid isn't working, you have lots of TSH. Everything in the pituitary, which is in the brain, is an alarm. And if you're a woman and your LH is high or whatever, your ovaries, your gonads, your female gonads aren't optimal. They're not producing enough estrogen. The body wants more. So if you do things in your life, you eat things well and you live your lifestyle in a good way, you're sleeping, whatever, whatever, your thyroid improves, your liver improves, your gonads improves, then your adrenals and your pituitary calm down. A lot of people have issues when they have too high activation of pituitary and adrenals. If you have PCOS, your adrenals are working hard when they shouldn't be. You have a lot of aldosterone. You have a lot of DHEA production in response to the high cortisol and adrenaline. The DHEA is there to protect against the cortisol. But if you had good ovarian function, if you had good liver and thyroid function, your adrenals would calm down. They wouldn't have much to do. Your pituitary wouldn't have much to do. So test your pituitary hormones, prolactin, TSH, LH, FSH. Test your adrenal hormones, cortisol, whatever. They shouldn't be doing much. They're here as, I don't want to say a backup, but the point is they have jobs to do, but the healthier and the better your other systems are working, the less the, I would say, more harmful systems have to work. So that's one thing I think relates to what you were just saying about pathways. This is like a higher level pathway thing. So
What
if
about
someone,
you said if the hormones are being produced from your brain, it's an alarm. Is that
the
how you said? If
pituitary,
it's
which is in the brain.
which is in the brain. So if the hormones are being produced from the pituitary, it's an alarm. That
Well, they're all
goes to
signaling hormones,
the
like
right. So it's signaling
thyroid
fight or your fight
stimulating
or flight.
hormone.
Your fight or flight. And
Well, yeah.
it's the backup generator, right? This is the Ray Peet thing. Kate Deering said it. Kitty Bloomfield says it. Everybody says it. If you are running on those hormones, you are using your backup generator. You're not using the power in your house that's built for running your electricity and your energy in your home. You had to call on a backup generator that's not meant to be used day and night.
The adrenals are running too strong. The backup generator is running too strongly. The adrenals should be used for what they need to, but when you start overdoing it, you have adult women with really bad acne. You have hair loss in a man or woman. You have migraines,
All the
any kinds of
things.
issues.
Yeah. I mean, it's the cortisol. You have cortisol belly, you have insulin resistance, you've
And
got
here's the cool
all
thing.
of it.
A lot of women, to fix their skin and hair issues, will take a drug, spironolactone. And part of what spironolactone is doing is actually suppressing the adrenals. But the more like physiological way to tell the adrenals to calm down is just to improve the thyroid and the gonads. The thyroid and the gonads are working. So in a woman, obviously, the thyroid and the ovaries, the ovarian function, the thyroid function, the adrenals will naturally say, I don't have much to do. And they'll calm down themselves. I'm not saying spironolactone's harmful. It could help if your adrenals are really overactive, but fixing the thyroid and the gonad function will lower the pituitary and adrenal, and you'll be doing good.
Right. Okay.
And one last quick thing, if you have the time, of course, one super quick. Since we talked about a lot of B vitamins, I just wanted to briefly, because I had been talking about biotin quickly, I just wanted to say there's lots of evidence that oxaloacetate is beneficial for PMS. And if it's beneficial for PMS, I'm assuming it's going to be beneficial for a lot of mood and behavioral things in general. Like, why was it good for PMS? Because the study said, oh, we lowered the suicidal ideation, we lowered the depression, the anxiety. So it wasn't just PMS is a pretty broad term, right? Like, if you read the study about oxaloacetate, it decreased a lot of things that sound like it's just normal depression, anxiety, different behavioral things. So it seems like oxaloacetate can be beneficial for anything we talked about today, including ADHD, OCD, whatever. But how's oxaloacetate made? You get glucose, you get pyruvate, and then you get pyruvate carboxylase. That's the enzyme that turns pyruvate into oxaloacetate. Pyruvate carboxylase is a strongly biotin-dependent enzyme. So it seems that my thinking is, if people benefit from oxaloacetate, they're probably not producing enough themselves. Biotin would be the main thing you can take to increase your own oxaloacetate. And guess what? Since oxaloacetate comes from pyruvate and glucose, if your glucose is high, if you're not using glucose well, if you eat your potatoes and your fruit, and you just don't feel like you're using the glucose well. Like you have the glucose, but you're not using it. The main thing people always talk about, including myself and Georgie, is vitamin B1, thiamine, because it oxidizes glucose. Well, biotin does as well, just a different enzyme. B1 is pyruvate dehydrogenase route. Biotin is pyruvate carboxylase route, and pyruvate carboxylase makes oxaloacetate. So if you have PMS, if you have ADHD, if you have any mood
Eczema,
symptoms,
skin stuff.
well, we'll get to the fungal thing in one second. But if you have behavioral stuff, instead of oxaloacetate, you might want to take biotin. Because if you take biotin, you're making more oxaloacetate, but you're also like improving that enzyme's function. You're probably using glucose better. You'll probably see your blood glucose will probably drop. If it's, let's say you have high blood glucose, your doctor's concerned, maybe biotin can help you. Biotin's clearly not for everyone, but it could help. You mentioned fungal. I asked Chris Masterjohn the other day, because Chris Masterjohn, PhD, has said, oh, biotin deficiency can lead to like increased chance of fungal infections on your skin and pink eye, conjunctivitis or whatever. And I said, hey, Chris, since that's the case, do you think biotin deficiency would make internal fungal issues worse, like oral thrush, any type of thrush, candida issues? And he goes, definitely. So, I mean,
Wow.
if you're struggling, and I know a lot of people talk about candida, yeast, candida, like it's all these things, and the only solution is that people are talking about is over-the-counter antifungals, prescription antifungals, and going on
Candida
a like zero
diets,
carb diet.
right?
Yeah. But it's like, if you're someone that, because I've spoken to some people that are like, they've been fighting candida for like a decade or whatever.
Me,
You,
almost my whole
maybe
life.
you just need, maybe you're severely biotin deficient for a long time. So it might not fix in a day or two. It might take a couple weeks or whatever, months. But
Yeah.
it seems that instead of taking a bunch of monalorin or undecalic acid or oregano,
It's never helped me.
if that's not working, you
Mm-mm.
might need biotin, because biotin deficient, I'm not saying biotin is antifungal, because I don't think it directly is. I just think biotin deficiency makes you more susceptible to fungal stuff. So you might need to fix your biotin before you can get rid of the maybe the super white tongue or the invasive candida, right? So biotin can be cool. The other thing I want to say, so biotin increases oxaloacetate, can be useful for fungal infections, can be useful for glucose utilization. It's been used at extremely high doses for MS, multiple sclerosis, and Huntington's. So obviously it's good for certain neurological things and, muscular or whatever. The other thing I want to say about biotin, I think it's the last thing, other than a caveat, which I'll say quickly, is biotin, Chris Masterjohn, you guys could find this on Chris Masterjohn's Substack if you want to find out more. He has a lot on biotin. He proposes that biotin deficiency can make you more susceptible to oxalate issues. So if you're someone that is like, oh, oxalates are ruining my life, you want to go into a low oxalate diet, you might also benefit from correcting a potential biotin deficiency, because he proposes that biotin deficiency can make you like very sensitive to oxalates, very more likely to have an issue with oxalates, oxalate dumping, all that, jargon. I don't know much about oxalates, but I know that biotin may help. So that's the last thing on biotin, other than I'll just say Ray Peet has said if you're going to take biotin in doses above 1 milligram, you can buy it up to 10 milligrams legally. 5 milligrams is a good dose, but if you're going to take above 1 or 2 milligrams, he says it's a good idea to take inositol or choline. And we'll talk a lot about choline in our next episode when we do on asthma. We didn't talk about asthma today, but when we do, I'll definitely talk about choline, because it phosphatidylcholine like cured my personal asthma. So, that's a quick soundbite on our next episode. But yeah, if you're going to supplement biotin, you might want to check if you are deficient. I don't know how you do that. Search Chris Masterjohn. I'm sure he'll tell you on YouTube. But yeah, biotin seems like if you're dealing with fungal issues, high blood glucose, if you have PMS, maybe your MS is in your family history, biotin might be cool. It helps with myelination of different nerve cells. So like biotin does a lot. It doesn't just make oxaloacetate. Biotin does a lot of things. But Ray Peet said, since it helps the myelination, high doses may lead to like fat in the liver, possibly. And that's why I think he said choline can help to, and if funny enough, where do you get biotin? In foods that are high in choline, like egg yolks. So maybe there's something to that. So that's the last thing since we talked about B vitamins. But you know what we should say? Since we both talked about how we use lifeblood, why don't we tell everyone our codes? What's
Right.
your
Well, you
code
give
for
your
that?
code. Go on then. I want to say, yeah, go ahead.
My code for anything that I'm affiliated with. So Onas, if you want Onas progesterone, it's Dean, DEAN. It's the same thing for lifeblood, DEAN, Dean. And if you think there's another store that I like, and they have a discount code, just try Dean. It might work because I have a code for a few places. But I'll just mention Onas and Lifeblood in this episode. But yeah, Dean will get you a discount. And I use the products myself, and they're great.
So do
So,
I.
yeah.
Let me tell you this. What else do people with oxalates constantly have? Almost synonymously, people with high oxalate issues have
I don't know.
candida.
Indeed. Okay, there we go. So biotin is probably playing a role. So
Yeah.
see, this episode a lot was about unappreciated cool B vitamins, because a lot of the focus has been on B1, B2, B3, folate, and B12 get so much attention. Like,
Right.
listen, all eight B vitamins are important, but I think B9 and B12 get too much attention for what they're doing. Like, they
Yeah.
deserve attention, but they get a little too much. B1, B2, B3, they deserve a lot of attention. They get a lot of attention. Great. But no one talks about B7, which is biotin. B6 is not that
Somewhat.
talked about, but it
Yeah.
is kind of popular compared to biotin. You know what the least talked about B vitamin is? Pantothenic acid, B5. And that's because the Greek origin of, the etymology of pantothenic acid is found everywhere vitamin. But that's harmful because since it's literally called the found everywhere vitamin, the pantothenic acid, pantos, thenes, whatever, no researcher has ever considered the issue of potentially people that are deficient in B5, but it can definitely exist. And B5, especially in the form pantothenine, when you take it, B5 is so necessary for adrenal health. It's so necessary for cholesterol utilization. So if you have high cholesterol, you may be low in B5. If you guys want to learn more about B5, probably the most underrated B vitamin because no one talks about it. Just Chris Master John has two-hour long episodes on it. I highly recommend them. You'll learn a lot. All the B vitamins are great, and the ones we don't talk about, we should talk about them more. So hopefully this episode is
Yeah.
adding to that.
What's your favorite B6?
I've been trying a few different ones. As long as it's P5P, you're good. Yeah,
Okay.
I tried out a slow release one. I don't know if that's gonna make a difference or not, but I bought the slow release one on Amazon, so it's 50 milligrams, but I'm getting a little throughout the day. Maybe that's more useful than just taking 50. Probably not though, because all the studies don't use slow release, so and they work. So I don't think it's necessary, but I've been playing around with different P5Ps, yeah. And
Okay.
biotin. I've been playing around with biotin recently. Yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
Perfect. What'd I tell you? What did I tell you? He is so thorough. And next time we're going to talk about asthma and some other stuff. But I wanted to just elaborate on the fact that, he messaged me and said, was thinking about my crazy little eczema problem that I have on my foot, right? I know a lot of you are bored with me talking about it, but it comes and goes and it's really strange. And I have been doing everything, right? Everything. And I've been studying gut health for going on 17 years. So when I say everything, I mean everything. And he sent me this message and said, have you thought of biotin? Like, and he tells me why, and he sends me this study, and he's showing me what Chris Master John talked about in regards to biotin. And of course, anything Constantine tells me, and I'm just like, purchase, purchase. He could sell me anything. And so I bought this high dose or high milligram, high dose biotin. And I'm telling you, I just felt it. When I grabbed that bottle, I felt like it just felt good to me, just holding that bottle in my hand. It's weird to say that, but and within a matter of days, I felt like something had shifted. And this eczema is strange because it went from being like a little rash to like a athlete's foot to like a almost like a thrush infection to like eczema, two different types of eczema to like now it looks like ringworm. So it's almost like imagine the human body, the whole human body, when someone is immune compromised and they can fall victim to just about anything, they'll get a cold and it'll turn into pneumonia, and then the pneumonia will cause problems down the line, and then all of a sudden they have constipation their whole lives, and then they've got gut issues. It's like an immune compromised foot. My right foot is like immunocompromised, and it's just getting whatever it gets, like it's just turning into all sorts of things. And I started taking something I've been consistent about has been that my husband has these like corticosteroid creams in his medicine cabinet. And so if it gets to the point where I'm like, I have to scratch it, I don't want to scratch it. So I just put this cream on it. And I've gone through like three tubes of this corticosteroid, not thinking anything about the fact that it's a hormone, right? Here I am working for Ona's, the CEO of Ona's. I know I'm learning so much about hormones. And I'm like, it never occurred to me that this darn corticosteroid could be elevating my cortisol and making me kind of crazy, which is how I've been feeling lately. Just super anxious, kind of like taking some steps back with my nervous system, feeling very easily upset by things. And I thought I had kind of gotten to this place where I was not that person anymore, shaking like little tremors, like a chihuahua, And I just thought I had gotten past all that. And then all of a sudden, this is going on. And I'm saying, what is going on with me? Started doing all the things, adrenal cocktails, all the things to support adrenal health and all the things. And then it hit me like an anvil on top of my head. I was like, oh my goodness, I have literally been taking corticosteroids for like 5 days out of the week for the last like 9 months. It's just nuts. It's crazy, So when people like in the estrogen dominance group are like, I'm so frustrated and nobody gets it and I've been trying everything. Listen, honey, we get it. Okay, we get it. I literally do this full time for a living and I'm still like, what? So I just wanted to share that with you. It also, especially because I read the Dutch. I interpret the Dutch test, and it shows. So they even say in the test, like if you're taking corticosteroids, like you need to know, you need to let us know that. It'd be ideal if you could get off of them before you take the test, because it's going to alter your cortisol readings. It's going to alter your adrenal function. It's going to alter, your adrenaline, norepinephrine, epinephrine, your cortisol, cortisone, all the way that you manage your cortisol, all of it. And I can't believe that got by me. So I wanted to share that with you. And do not forget about the Dutch. They're still having their sale, which I'm passing on to you. So if you use HGG 75, you're going to get $75 towards the test, plus the interpretation, plus your recommendations, plus any information like remedies, detox remedies, stuff like that, recipes to adrenal cocktails and so forth. So if you are interested in that, do it soon because March is coming and their prices are going to go up and then mine will go back up too. So go on to the link in the bio. There's a bunch of information that Dean shared with us during this show that you can click on and check out. And then of course, Ona's, us.onasnatural.com. Do not forget, oh my goodness, the progesterone guidebook, friends. Holy moly. Now you can get it's the book I've been writing for however many years, but it's been condensed into a guidebook, and it's a progesterone therapy guidebook. It's basically therapeutic uses for bioidentical progesterone, and it's really good, really good, and it's free. So go on to us.onasnatural.com and click on the link there. It's in the show notes. And you will, if you have already signed up for my newsletter, you're going to have to clear your cookies on your website, on the website to sign up for the podcast, I mean for the newsletter. For the progesterone guidebook. If you can't get it, just email me, please, at healthygutgirl@gmail.com. Okay? All right, friends, thank you so much.